Hello and welcome to this special episode on Oxfam In Depth, the show where we share the latest thought, learning and knowledge from Oxfam for the wider sector. I'm Amy Moran and I'm from Oxfam's Policy and Practice team. For today's episode, we're sharing an audio recording of our recent event, Feminist Leadership and the Hardest Places to Be a Woman, held in London on February 3rd. It was part of Oxfam's Breaking New Ground series, and we welcomed a panel of some truly inspiring feminist leaders from civil society, politics, and peacebuilding. They shared their stories and gave their perspectives on what feminist leadership means to them. The panel was chaired by Annie Kelly, a human rights journalist for The Guardian, and she facilitated a conversation with Dr. Fenella Porter, who is the co-director of women's rights here at Oxfam GB. Then the panel included Rasha Obaid, who directs the Gender Justice and Peace Program at the Peace Track Initiative, a Yemeni non-governmental organization founded and staffed by Yemeni women. It also included Hala Al-Kharibi, who is the regional director of the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa, and Ria Youadé, a 28-year-old South Sudanese woman who is passionate about peace and women's human rights. And finally, UK Member of Parliament Preet Gill, who was elected for Birmingham Edgbaston in 2017 and is the UK's first female Sikh MP and was appointed Shadow Minister for International Development in January 2018. We hope you enjoy, and if you'd like more reflections from this event, please make sure to check out our blog, Oxfam Views and Voices. Details are available in the description of this episode. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Tony. And yes, I'm Fenella. I'm one of the co-directors of Women's Rights and Gender Justice at Oxfam GB, and I am absolutely delighted to welcome you all this evening to this, which is the third of our Breaking New Ground event series. And this one is on feminist leadership in the hardest places to be a woman. Now, before I start, I just want to thank Tony and the team, Salia and the others, who have worked incredibly hard to pull this event together. And I'm actually going to come back to their efforts at the end, when I'm coming to the end of my words, because I think what they've been doing with this event is actually really special. It's not just about sending invites out. It's not just about making a fantastic panel. It is about how they've gone about this. So this event really draws together both the work that we're doing on gender justice and women's rights and some of the lessons that we've been learning about how to approach our work differently. We've been finding in our work and the work of our partners and allies throughout the world that there are real connections between whose voices are in the room, whose voices are being heard, and how poverty and injustice is addressed. So unless women's voices are being heard clearly and loudly, policy making and economic decision making will only see half of the picture, and it will not address their experiences, it won't reflect their expertise, and all too often it can actually reinforce gendered inequalities. So it is really important that we have women in leadership positions. But despite some really high-profile women leaders that we have in heads of states or other government positions, women are actually really badly represented in national parliaments, for example. So only, I think, 24%, at the beginning of last year, 24% of all national parliamentarians were women. And yet we know that women and their organisations have many of the answers to the inequalities that they're living with. And in crucial spaces like peace negotiations, women are barely present. And yet evidence from over 180 peace agreements globally shows that peace agreements with women signatories directly result in more durable peace. And where they are represented, women are too often subjected to increasing backlash and real brutal violence. And this means that their voices are heard less. And gendered poverty and injustice continues to be invisible and continues to damage women's lives. It also reiterates a really powerful message to young women that you don't matter, that these are not your spaces. But the women that you'll hear from tonight will make clear that there is nothing further from the truth. But let us also be crystal clear that the inequality and the injustice that is faced by women leaders is not just about gender. Women of colour, working class women, Lesbian and trans women and women from Indigenous communities suffer discrimination on multiple fronts, and they're also subjected to even more violent and intense backlash. It's not just the forces of patriarchy that exclude women from leadership. The forces of racism, colonialism, and elitism are all hard at work here as well. But whilst it's really important to have women in leadership positions, this politics of presence, as you might call the representative nature of it, is just the start. For us, it's really important that we're talking tonight about feminist leadership, and that's quite different from women in leadership. Feminist leadership is transformative leadership. It's about how we challenge and change the idea of leadership, the definitions, the practices that we use, and perhaps most importantly, the spaces that we operate in. So this goes way beyond individual leaders, and it forces us to consider how decision-making spaces are actually linked to marginalized communities. How can we make those links? How can it not be about just individual women operating in an otherwise man-shaped world? So it's important to get women in power, but to be transformational, we need to go further and we need to look at the power itself. How this excludes through assumptions of knowledge, for example, or expertise, or gravitas, or leadership qualities. So we have feminist models of leadership which are emerging. In Sweden, Canada, and I think now Mexico, we all have feminist foreign policies. New Zealand has a well-being economy that it's pursuing. And these all demonstrate that it's not just about what individual women can do. It is more about a collective leadership that ensures that policy-making and decision-making spaces and the analysis within them are feminist. And this brings me to why this event is important on another level. It is an illustration of how we can work differently. Power inequalities based on gender, race, colonialism that sit within development continue to silence the very women that we NGOs and activists work alongside and accompany. It goes without saying that as a sector, we have been complicit in the marginalization of women's voices. So the way that this event was envisaged was to amplify those who should be heard and to put into practice some of the feminist leadership principles that we've adopted to make our work better. So Tony, Salia, and the rest of the team working on this have managed to show how events like this can be part of how we, as an INGO, can reframe our privileged access to some of the platforms and the spaces of power to open them and share them with others who share our politics and our transformative agendas. We can do the work without being the center of the stage. So our feminist principles are asking us to share power, to understand how gender intersects with race, class, inequality, ability, and all other aspects of identity, to create different experiences of discrimination. They ask us to support women and women's movements and not speak on behalf of others, but to make the space for them to speak on their own behalf. So tonight, we've tried to be really intentional about centering those voices that we need to hear. And I think we're really, really privileged to have the panelists that we have with us tonight who come from within and beyond women's rights spaces, and we must learn from them. There is an urgency now. We're seeing a significant rollback and more violence that's faced by women and particularly feminist leaders and activists. But I think it's also important to be really inspired by them and to stand alongside them and hear from them directly. So in that spirit, I'm now going to hand over the mic first to Annie, who's going to facilitate tonight's discussion. Thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy what will be a magnificent evening.
Hello, everyone. I'm Annie Kelly. I'm a journalist and an editor at The Guardian and Observer newspapers, and I can't tell you how thrilled I am to be here tonight. I said this before to Fenella, but this is hands down the best panel I've ever sat next to at any event I've chaired over the last couple of years. I'm really, really, really excited about kind of some of the discussions we're going to be having tonight. So before I introduce the panel, just to give you a bit of an idea of how it's going to work, we're going to hear from each of the panelists, and then we're going to have a bit of a discussion between all of us, and then we'll open up as quickly as possible as we can to questions from the audience, because I'm sure there's going to be lots and lots of things you'd like to ask all of these incredible women we've got here tonight. So I would like to start by introducing to my left, this is Hala Al-Karib. She is the regional director of the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa, which is a network of women's rights organizations. Sitting next to her is Rasha Obaid, the director of the Gender, Justice and Peace Programme at the Peace Track Initiative, which is an NGO founded by Yemeni women. Next to her is Preet Gill, the MP for Birmingham Edgbaston, who was elected in 2017, and she was appointed the Shadow Minister for International Development in 2018. And finally, Ria William Yayanda, who is a South Sudanese activist and peace builder. So first, I would like to invite Hala to say a few words, and I was wondering if she would like to tell us about her experience working as an activist and all of the incredible work that her network has been doing.
Absolutely, thank you. I'm going to start now.
Okay.
Good evening, everybody. And first, I would like to say thank you very much to Oxfam for giving us this space to speak to you. Specifically, I would like to thank Oxfam Gender Justice and Women Rights Program. My name is Hala, and I was born and raised in Sudan. I'm the director of the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa, and it's a cross-country women rights initiative that works in six countries, including Sudan, South Sudan, Somalia, Djibouti, Ethiopia, and we work with Eritrean communities in different countries across the Greater Horn of Africa. I have been a political and women rights activist since the age of 14, and this was quite normal for my generation. We were early politicized early on. The organization I work for, SIHA, or the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa, works to challenge the status quo and the notion that Horn of Africa women are victims. So this is one of the core things in our values. We acknowledge that almost all the challenges that women face are based on the socially constructed norms and politics. We work through and firmly believe in the collective power of women. And we are convinced beyond any doubt that if African women and women from the region I work for and around the world, if we were given the space, we will drive change in our region and beyond. And the story of women from my country, Sudan, who led the Sudanese revolution, clearly defies the presumption about African women and their assumed victimhood. In the region where we are working, religious militancy and fundamentalism often disguise itself as an ideology that brings people together against tribal and ethnic polarization. In fact, religious fundamentalism and militancy, in our view, is growing to become one of the critical threats to women's human rights across our region. This is why we work in my organization on addressing religious militancy strategically by supporting women rights activists to counter religious militancy discourse and the social infiltrations. And doing so, we are connecting to women and girls across the region. And our connection to the women and girls across the region is deepened. SIHA works on challenging militarizations and military institutions as they perpetuate the subjugation of women in order to maintain power. Our work on sexual violence in Sudan and in South Sudan is not about victimizing women or blaming the evil men and boys in our communities, as much as it's about addressing the contextually specific root causes of sexual violence, which are sustained through the political dynamics and the misogynistic ideologies that capitalizes on violations against women. Not only against women, but also against men as an instrumental means to maintain power. We believe in women economic growth and equal access to employment. We believe in the importance of women's equal inclusion in the middle jobs and vocational jobs. Our work with women in the informal sector in Kampala, in Hargeisa, and in Khartoum unveils women who have been rendered as invisible and unprotected as a result of their exclusion from the formal economy. My organization mostly focus and work with women in the urban poor societies. I mean, we take into consideration the huge and the massive change, you know, that's happening, you know, in the demography of the region where we see massive migrations from rural to urban area. As an African feminist organization, we believe that women cannot be reduced into a monolithic entity with a single set of belief. Women comprise half of the population of the world. And thus, we are entitled into our own political beliefs, into our own stance, and we work to build an inclusive women movement, but also, you know, we respect women diversity. And also, we believe that women activists and their organizations should have the ability to decide on how to be supported. And this is very, very important. And, you know, for those who want to support women and girls' rights, we should approach this from a solidarity point of view rather than from a charity point of view. And I'd just like to stress that, you know, when relationships are constructed around money or resources, relationships becomes about money only. And that's really very problematic on the dynamic of support at the moment. Finally, and to conclude, I'd like to just leave you with a few thoughts. For many depoliticized women and humanitarian organization, we might seem as an outsider. However, we believe that we are insiders to the women movement in the Greater Horn of Africa. So we are very much advocate for the politicizations of women rights organizations. And as an African Sudanese woman coming from a Muslim society, leading a growing women rights organizations, I have learned how to navigate through polarized and discriminatory environment. Time and again, my leadership has been challenged, but regardless of this being an ongoing struggle, I have owned it, and I am very proud of my struggle. Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much.
So I'd now like to introduce Rasha, and I think Rasha is going to talk to us about her experiences of how important it is that the Yemeni women's voices are heard in the current conflict.
I'll go there too. I like that.
Okay.
Short. Hello, everyone. I'm very happy and proud to be here. It's really amazing to be in a place where we all have similar goal, but we also work in different places. So I look forward to speaking to as many people as possible after the panel, and also hearing the rest of the stories here. I'm going to tell you about the importance of women participation in the peace process in Yemen. But to explain that, I will tell you about my work before the war when I was in Yemen, and also now after the war. So I worked for about 10 years in Yemen in women's rights, in combating violence against women, but also mostly in women participation. So at that time, and until now, Yemen is the worst place for women. It's in the bottom of the gender gap. The reason why, so before the war, I remember when I was working on quota, working with try to get quota for women to participate both in the parliament and also in local councils. In the parliament, we had 300 men and a woman. So that was in the elections of 2006, and that was the last elections we had for the parliament. And she passed away a few years ago, by the way, so now we have only men. And in the local councils, we had about 76 women versus more than 700 men in the local councils. So I was working in project in both things since 2009. So we would go and we were trying to do that, but when there's no will from the top down, it was really very difficult. And now you can imagine how it is after the war. So after the war, I became a refugee here in the UK. I work for Peace Track Initiative. It's an organization that the goal of the organization is to amplify the voices of women and youth, because the peace process is lacking the voices of women who are actually working on the ground. The way we're doing, so we're doing it in different levels. We have a network of more than 300 women, Yemeni women, working in Yemen and also outside Yemen. They're working on building peace among their communities. So many of them have, for example, one of our partners, she runs an alliance of women. It's called Mothers of Abductees. They managed to free 600 abductees who disappeared. All they did is that they went everywhere and they were demanding to see their children and their husbands. Also within our network, we have women who work with women detained by the Houthi militia. We have women who work in cultural projects, women who manage to open passages for aid in besieged areas, women who solved conflicts within tribes, sometimes just over water well. And the challenges these women face are just horrendous. It's crazy. And for us as people who are working in this, it's also surprising. We don't have a manual that says how to work as an activist and what to do. You know, it's always dynamic. So we've had within our network a woman who was, for example, detained by the Houthi militia for about 3 weeks. She was tortured. There's sexual violence, everything you can imagine. And the reason why is because she worked in peace. So the word peace is not allowed. It's considered Western, kind of, you know, under the militia controlled areas. And once she was freed, she was allowed to leave only because she said, "I will not work in peace again." And we managed to help her leave the country. So we have also part of the work we do within our organization is to help human rights defenders. Another story is a woman who also was detained for a few months. She was a humanitarian, so she worked in a humanitarian organization. She was detained, and her family automatically disowned her. And that's something, maybe, I don't know how much you know about Yemen, but in Yemen, it's dishonored for a woman to be put in jail. So it's like, okay, she's not our daughter anymore. And her brother was trying to kill her. So we had to help her also leave the country. So this is the kind of things women go through. So this is the work we were doing with them. The reason why it's very important to have women in the peace process now is because, well, the only time we had a woman was in the Stockholm meeting. It was only one woman, but we usually have no women. They say, well, it's informal meetings, we will have the woman later on, but now we don't need the women. While on the ground, women are doing all that work and the men are fighting. And then they come back to the communities with all this hatred. They don't understand what the women went through, what the women were bearing in order to create peace and to be able to support their families and their communities. Unfortunately, sometimes this leads some of the women to join one of the warring parties just so that their voices are being heard. What I really want to join voices with Hala. This is really important. Women are not only victims. Women are actors. Just putting them in the box that they are victims is very narrowing, and it's also very disempowering to them. We need to look at them as actors, and we need to support their work. They're not only that women who need some money or some food. They are doing a lot of work, and they deserve to be in the peace process. Thank you.
And now I'd like to invite Preet to talk about her journey into politics and what she's learned about feminist leadership through her work.
Thank you. I remember my first local Labour Party meeting being dominated by middle-aged white men and, well, lots of Asian men as well. Many of them had given, obviously, very excellent service to their communities, sometimes for many decades. However, it was always good but quite surprising when a woman spoke up and offered a female perspective. But as I became more active, I continued to experience many barriers and, in some cases, blatant misogyny, even as a councillor in the cabinet. And I can remember being told to go home to look after my kids and not to concern myself with certain issues or debates. And even as a female MP, it is so clear that the fight to remove obstacles and provide opportunities is still not over. I'm incredibly lucky and grateful to have become the first female Sikh MP in the UK, but I'm also frustrated that it took until 2017 for that to happen. And when I was growing up, there were two people I looked up to, and that was my father and Sophia Dilip Singh. And I don't think my dad would mind me starting with Sophia. She was the granddaughter of Maharaja Ranjit Singh, who ruled the Sikh Empire from 1801 to 1839, and she was the goddaughter of Queen Victoria. She was a fierce campaigner for women to have the right to vote in this country, and I feel quite honoured to have campaigned in the very same streets and neighbourhoods as the world-famous Christabel Pankhurst and the formidable Mary MacArthur. In 1918, both these women campaigned to enter Parliament in constituencies which are now partially subsumed into the Worli constituency, where I grew up and became a councillor. And we should never underestimate the work that has since gone into making Parliament gradually come to reflect and look more like the people it serves. Real sacrifices went on along the way to achieve women's representation that we have today. But still, if you look at the number of female members of Parliament or councillors who are women, we haven't reached the end. And I know that I would never have become Britain's first woman Sikh MP without the commitment of those that went before me. The other person that I looked up to was my father. He was president of the Gurdwara in Smethwick for 18 years and set up the first food bank during the 1980s recession. He worked with the miners during their strikes and raised funds to support them, and he championed interfaith working. He was also incredibly supportive of me and my siblings, always encouraging us to get an education and to do well. Learning lessons from a personal story is always so difficult, and I know how fortunate I have been to get to where I am today. But I've had pushback. I remember asking to become a cabinet member after a year that I became a councillor, as the children's services had probably one of the worst Ofsted inspections. And given my background, I thought this would be great. Surely they're going to accept me. But it was made very clear to me in no uncertain terms that I should get back in my box. I have two young daughters, and I'm determined to ensure that they enjoy the same opportunities as their peers, irrespective of gender, race, religion, or whatever other identity they choose to have or not have. But the issues of today are not the same as they were in my youth, and we need to be clear that the wealth of experience that everyone in this room has is different and valuable in guiding and advising, but should never and can never be a blueprint for success for anyone else. I've been incredibly lucky to have met some truly fantastic women leaders in politics, and the only advice I give to the people interested in pursuing a life in politics is to learn from those who have come before. You don't always have to replicate or copy, but you have to soak up as much knowledge and expertise as possible to shape who it is that you become. And key to that is engaging with it at a critical level. And after 2.5 years as a Member of Parliament, I'm still learning every single day, and I think that is the key to never stop learning. In politics, most people get involved because they want to change the world, usually for the better. Again, another thing that I've learned is that no one in politics thinks that they are baddies. Before my time is up, I just wanted to touch on the work I've been leading on with Labour's international development team to develop the UK's first truly international development policy. And the intention is to move away from an instrumentalisation of gender equality as a means to an end, and instead move towards embedding a human rights approach which seeks to overturn and transform the structural drivers of gender inequality. And I want to end by explaining what I think feminist leadership is. For me, it is the desire and constant challenge to ourselves to try and change a system that is built on historic privilege. Changing the system and acknowledging that privilege is not just for women, but for everyone that the current structures exclude and infringe upon. Events like this are a celebration, so thank you, Oxfam. They show the strength that we have, but they're also a reminder of the struggles that still exist and which will come. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Preet. And finally, Rhea, who is going to talk on her experience of being such an having such an important leadership role at such a young age.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening. That's better. My name is Rhea William Uyada, a women's human rights and peace activist from South Sudan, and I recently just started writing with the African Feminism, just sharing stories of girls and women. And I'm excited to be in this room and on this great panel as well. And I thank Oxfam for bringing me here to learn and unlearn and to share my stories. And I know that I found a sister, Annie, who will be teaching me to become a better writer. Back home in South Sudan, I work with a feminist organization called Crown the Woman, South Sudan, that I and six other young sisters we founded. And with Crown the Woman, we work a lot in peace building. We also speak a lot on violence towards girls and women. We do a lot of activities in schools. We have school clubs, and also we involve power holders like chiefs. In South Sudan, chiefs have a lot of power, so we put them in dialogues and have conversations with them, the parents, and also issues like child marriage through our campaign called Too Young to be Married. Recently, we worked with strong South Sudanese young women and older women and came up with a campaign called Girls and Women Are Born to Lead, and Oxfam has been pushing us a lot through that, and we thank you for that. Looking at South Sudan, the world's youngest nation, yet we have, when you look at the statistics of the world, we come mainly last. If you look at child marriage, we're among the worst, like it's at 52%. Most girls are not able to celebrate their 18th birthday if you're not married. So you can see how bad it is. If you look at South Sudan, there's intentional exclusion of women in processes, in leadership, in peace-building processes. For example, our recently concluded peace talks, there were very few women in the process, but comparing it to the past talks, it has increased from 25% to 35%. So this is a struggle. Women have been fighting, women have been pushing, and this is feminist leadership. It's about pushing, it's about claiming spaces, and it's about bringing voices of all people, not just women, to the table. When we speak about feminist leadership, a lot comes to my mind, and I have so many questions. First of all, dissecting what feminism means, I mean, coming from South Sudan. I recently wrote an article called The F Word, because if you speak about feminism, they look at you like, what the F are you talking about? And so I called it the F word because we have to digest it. We have to tell people what it means. We have to let people know that it's about inclusion. Feminism is peaceful and not really the F word. Feminism is a journey for me. It's a leadership. It's not just you don't wake up one day and say, boom, I'm a feminist, so you should be feminist. We don't force people, but we let people see that you can be feminist and you can change the world. It's about the different kinds of feminisms. You know, it's all that is inclusive. It's about hard work and resilience. This is feminism. The fact that it's also very difficult environment where I come from to work in, and yet women keep on fighting to create change. That to me is feminist leadership. For example, women have been part of our process, as I said before, but we have to struggle to be included in the table, yet we are the ones who suffer the most, and to bring our voices on the table, in the corridors. And what is interesting that if we have women, we don't only speak about women's issues. We always speak, what about the youth? What about the children? What about our husbands who are being killed? So as feminism is about us and not about women only. So we should take that in our mind. Also, it's about what is the women peace agenda? What is it that should be involved and spoken about? When we speak about security, it's most times you find a bunch of men speaking about guns, speaking about nuclear weapons, and we forget to even mention what does it mean? What does peace mean to a young girl who is being forced into marriage? What does peace mean to a woman who is being raped? What does peace mean to what is even how the gun is produced and what impact it's creating on that. And I just want to share our great work that we are doing in South Sudan. For example, we recently came up with a campaign called Girls and Women Are Born to Lead. And this campaign is basically proactive to show that we are not begging for this space. We want this space as women. Women fought for 35%. We wanted 50%, but we were accorded 35%. And so with this, we want to show the whole world that South Sudanese women are not just born to be married, not just born to be cooks, but born to lead as well. Transformative feminism is very expensive. It costs one life, resources, and also you face consequences. If you call yourself feminist, you have to be able to answer questions, to defend yourself, to teach people. But also I want to highlight that there are so many challenges that brings with that. And for example, for me as a young woman, it's tough to talk about feminism in such a society that is fully patriarchal. I have to keep on explaining myself. I have to keep on teaching people, which is tough, but it's welcoming as well. And the societal expectation of a woman. As a young girl in South Sudan, you have to grow up thinking, if I go to school, I have to get married. That's the end goal. But how do we then stop that and teach the young girls that you should look beyond that, look at leadership, which is normally not involved in the equation? So finally, I'll request you that are here that let us work together to mentor us, the young girls. There is a big disconnect between the older women and us, the young girls. As she said, we need to learn from the young, from the older women, so we need to close that gap. There is need to support women to rebuild the movements with a feminist lens, not just ticking the box of we trained women, we supported women, but how do we sustain those movements? The international community needs to invest in developing our countries. We need to look beyond symptoms and address root causes. Finally, I will ask this later because she has the powers here, but we need to take care of the self and we'll do that later. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone. It was just so many things to kind of think about and discuss and deconstruct there. I was just, you know, obviously the theme of this Oxfam series is breaking new ground. And I just wanted to ask all of the panel, really, we've talked about what feminist leadership is or is to all of you, but I wonder kind of what does it look like in the communities that you are working in? Can you kind of give me some examples of what feminist leadership you are seeing and you are encouraging and growing in your own communities or the communities that you're working with? Anyone? Hala, would you like to?
Sure. So, I mean, what we are doing, I mean, we are reconstructing and rebuilding new norms. And we're reshaping our existence, you know, as women within our communities by challenging the status quo that we should not be occupying public spaces, we should not speak loudly about issues, and we should not have an opinion. And this is how, you know, feminist looks like at the community level. You know, when you show up in the public spaces and when you are part of the, you know, of the day-to-day struggle of people, you know, as a woman, you know, and you bring the with you the voices and the concerns and the agenda, you know, of other women who are not in the same space. And I've seen this happening, you know, during the course of last year, working with the women in the resistance committees who fought through the Sudan revolution and, you know, stood up against one of the most brutal and hideous and terrible regimes. And they completely changed the narrative. You know, Sudan has one of the worst legal framework. You know, women used to be flogged, they used to be, you know, persecuted for just being in a public space, for their dress code, for making a living as street vendors. And how women, by being in part of the political movement, how they change the perceptions. And those are just, you know, normal average women, you know, and how they reclaim that. And I think this is how it should be done. Yeah.
And Rasha, I mean, the women that you work with are working in a very dangerous environment. Can you talk a bit about some of the challenges, some of the breakthroughs that some of the women that you've had have experienced in the last year or so?
Yeah, sure. It's already working. Okay. So I would want to also join voices with Hala and Rhea about the same idea. So what we do in the organization, so as you said, women have so many challenges. We need to push their voices for them to be heard. So what we do is that we managed to, as she said, to claim our space. So whenever there are meetings with the government, the UN, whatever, we just send women and we go there. We don't wait for them to invite us. We go there, we bring women from Yemen, we bring those who managed to leave, and we bring them because they know they have the issues, they want to talk about them, and we go to those places. We went to Stockholm, they will be like, okay, we will give up a bit. We will have some committees of women. We can have women on the side, in the committee, in the group, but not on the table. They always do that. So that's one thing. The second thing, we managed to be also in, so we're leading actually the track two consultations when it comes to women. Do you know the track two? So the peace process is track one, which is the warring parties talking about weapons and prisoners in every country. And then track two is thematic themes, what organizations are talking about, issues, other issues, where they will have research and studies about women, but not necessarily women being included in them. And then we have track three, which is people who are working on the ground who are usually disconnected from all these tracks. So what we do is that we bring these to track two, and also to track one and a half, what we managed to do is to be there, but not yet on the table. And but, you know, I mean, it's very difficult. I mean, for us, for example, I'm someone who lives here in the UK, but then I'm not, you know, they look at us as we're doing something wrong. Why are you living alone? My family is in Yemen. Why are you, you know, why is your hair showing? Why are you traveling alone? These things we had to also challenge all these stereotypes. And it's interesting how this is actually empowering, but it's very difficult in an environment where women should not be seen in a public space at all. So you have to do it knowing that this is something that that I have to do, you know, regardless of the implications. So yeah, thanks.
Yeah, please. Very, very quickly, I mean, I'm just speaking to what you've said. We cannot exercise feminism in isolations. We cannot be feminist in closed rooms on private spaces. If we really want to claim our feminism, we have to be out there, everywhere. Yeah, and I guess this is what you were talking about. Yeah.
I was going to say that, you know, becoming an MP, the amount of issues when you're trying to address the structural changes, it becomes very difficult because suddenly your priorities are the priorities of lobbyists, of constituents, of political priorities, and whatever brief it is that you're doing. And so whilst you come in there and you think, actually, I'm going to do this, you very quickly realise that if there isn't a collective, if there isn't the support networks to help you as a woman to absolutely tackle some of these structural changes, it's really disheartening and you absolutely get exhausted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were talking, interestingly, you come to Parliament and you expect there to be policy coherence and you expect there to be really lots of advisers and you expect them to actually get this right. And you come here and you realise, oh my goodness, I'm actually having to talk about the very basics again, the things that you assume people get and understand and will have in their minds when they're developing policy and thinking about services. But actually, it's not like that at all. It's like you constantly have to really raise these issues over and over again. And I think as a new MP, you go through this period in Parliament when you start, it's almost like an imposter syndrome because everyone expects you to know everything about everything. And you don't, because you're learning all the time. You're learning about parliamentary protocols. You're learning about you're trying to find out what are the actual issues that I really want to raise and I want to be successful in this Parliament. And, you know, it's been really quite frustrating because there's some great MPs and we have 45% Labour Party is female. But even then, it's not enough because we all have so many expectations. I mean, being a mother, you know, the fact that, you know, you've almost kind of get yourself into a position where you feel grateful you can do this role. And so when you go home, you quickly adopt the role of doing the domestic chores and being the mum and actually doing everything else because you feel so bad for not being around and for trying to tackle and challenge things and trying to teach your daughters that actually they should learn to speak out. It's not right that people are constantly telling you to sit back in your box. And then again, in terms of the shadow ministerial role, I think there's three real things that we want to do. Of course, have a feminist international development policy because there hasn't been one. And I think that's really important. And we really, me and my team, we talked about this in terms of what does it look like in Africa? What does it look like in different parts of the world? Because this word feminism means different things to different people. And we kind of broke it down into three areas around DFID as an organization. It itself has got to be feminist. It's got to have the training. It's really got to understand the impact of its policies absolutely at the grassroots. And as a funder, what we can't do then is create more laborious procedures and make it difficult for women to access funding. We've got to be able to go right to the root cause and fund them directly. And we've got to be an influencer. You know, I met some women recently that are working in an area of conflict. And one of the things that they said is we want a seat on the table as negotiators. And we do not want to be seen as anything less. We don't want to be advocates or given other nice roles. Actually, we are very capable of negotiating on our behalf. And I think that's really important. So it's an exciting piece of work. We had an election. We didn't get to finish it. So it's something we're going to go back to completing. And actually, it's been great to have the sector involved in that piece of work.
Yeah. Can I say something? I mean, it's also about it's about also transforming the patriarchal mind. I just want to share a short story. Recently, I went to some village in my country to talk about women's leadership, and there was a room full of male commissioners. There was no female commissioner. And I was just talking about female leadership, including women in leadership. And then All the men in the room said, we are who we are because of our mothers. We have become commissioners because of our mothers. And then one unfortunately disagreed and said, no, women cannot lead. I said, why? He said, because women are not educated. Women cannot handle the country's issues. Women can't. And I'm like, oh, this is too much can'ts. And I'm like, okay. So you're saying women are not educated. I'm like, okay, all of us in this room who are women are either organizing or directing you or serving you. And I'm like, women in this room, we are going to do a small exercise. If you have a degree, a university degree, please stand up. And the men stood up. And then I said, if you have the degree, remain standing. If you don't, sit down. And even the gentleman who said women are not educated, did not have a university degree, he sat down. And I'm like, the girls or the ladies in the room, if you have a university degree, please stand up. And they stood up. And I was like, okay, you see, all of us here have university degree. And even you who are saying women are not educated do not have university degrees. So should we chase you out of the room? And... they just laughed. But it's also about just having a dialogue and a conversation. It's tough. It's always, you cannot do this, I can do it better. But it's about unpacking and also saying, we can do this as long as we are competent as well. It's also about defining what leadership is. And for me, my struggle as a young woman has been, when you ask for South Sudanese, they're going to give you a man. When you ask for a youth, they're going to give you a male youth. If you ask for a woman, they're going to give you an old woman. Mm. So where are we, the young women? So we have to struggle. But even in this struggle, we have to keep on defining that leadership is about everyone. Leadership is about sacrificing. Leadership is about putting people's beliefs, ideas first, and then you as a leader, you come last. And this is what feminism is about, and those are the conversations we don't really speak about, and this is the right time to speak about them.
Yeah. And obviously we're facing a time of unprecedented challenges, backlash against women's rights, against access to reproductive health, about the terrible violence facing women, human rights defenders. You know, the world is a very, very dangerous place for many, many women to just be women. I was wondering if you had anything to say on that. Like, what is it? What are the greatest challenges that women are facing in the communities where you're working? What are the biggest battles that we're facing in the world today?
I think the backlash is a reminder that we shouldn't take things for granted, that, you know, that equality was always very, very volatile. Mm. And it's something that we should never stop fighting for. And you know, this is not something about women in the South or in Africa, or, you know, this is about, I think, globally, you know, and I don't think it's all also about women alone. It's about, you know, all of us, you know, in terms of, you know, our stance and so on. So the backlash is definitely a reminder. I think in our part of the world, we have always been struggling with the backlash. So it's, you know, actually we are, interesting enough, you know, I mean, in that part of the world, things are really changing. I mean, there is a lot of optimism. I look around in, you know, in Sudan, in Ethiopia, what's happening, the change in politics, tendency towards, you know, sort of opening up civil spaces. In South Sudan, there is some optimism. And, you know, before we were talking, before we come here, we were talking about, you know, that, you know, as women, you know, we are really very clear about the fact that we pay it for the cost of peace, and that peace is very, very costly and expensive thing. And we are, you know, sort of trying to learn more about that and to share that with young people in the communities we are working with, we are tired of war and we are tired of conflict, and, you know, we are in a transition at this point of time. And I know that the whole idea of, you know, resources and support, I think support is definitely beyond resources. You know, I think all of us need to be more creative in terms of how we should actually extend. Mm. I mean, and not beyond money, resources is so many other things, you know, but how we can extend solidarity, you know, and support towards each other. Mm. Yeah.
And there's been a lot of talk about collective action and solidarity and movement building. Is that one way? I mean, do you feel that that's a step that we've already seen that is a way of kind of energizing and promoting a kind of fight back against this backlash on women's rights across the world?
I think so. I mean, I think if we saw the case of Samira Ahmed taking on the BBC, I mean, I think I read a statistic the other day that it's going to take about 202 years to close the global economic gap in terms of gender pay. And so whilst we're seeing it here, we know that it exists far worse in other countries where women just don't even have access to those kind of platforms to even challenge that position. And I think for us, actually, it was really heartening to see that case, because actually this is a woman who wasn't going to take no and took on and established a huge media company. And the great thing actually about that case is about a month before, as a group of MPs, we actually met with a lot of BAME journalists and people working in the media, and they'd all come to share really some of their stories. And I was absolutely horrified to just hear, based on race, your gender, your class, just the kind of discrimination that still goes on and you wouldn't expect, and it's much more worse. But, of course, we know that there's about 130 million school-age young girls in primary and secondary that are still not accessing education. I mean, the very way of women coming out of poverty is a huge issue, and I think something like 650 million girls are actually married before the age of 18, and this is still a huge issue, especially in places like India, for example, where it's pretty much accepted in certain cultures about child marriages. And how do you actually tackle that, and how do we actually, from an international development perspective, where we're not in countries where we know these issues still exist, how do we actually work with organisations there and influence and shape? And I think social media has given us a platform to really raise our voices in a way that we've not had, because all of a sudden, globally, you can pick up what the issues are and you can get on with them. But there are far too many issues, and there isn't enough of the collective groups of women coming together and picking one or two of those issues and saying, we're absolutely going to work on this and not overlap what other women's organisations are doing, or maybe work together. I think there needs to be much more collaboration where I've seen women's groups.
And Fenella and a couple of other of you raised this, you know, when you were speaking before, you know, have... kind of has the role of the international development community, the big INGOs, has that played a role in perhaps not facilitating those movements emerging and developing?
I'd like to say something here. I think, the challenges and the problems that's happening in the South, it is the challenges and the problems of the people who are living in the South. I mean, I'm not specifically talking about, the region where I exist and work, in the Greater Horn of Africa. And I'll give an example. For 40 years or more, most of the international support has been going on to support, for example, an issue like female genital mutilations. And we made the point, in my organization that we will never work on female genital mutilation as an issue independently from other issues, that actually, subjugate and, other forms of violence against women, because it's just a symptom for a very deep problem, and we looked at the statistics, for example. We looked at the reports from the gynecologist societies in Somalia, in Sudan, and we found out, like, for example, during the 1980s and 70s, female genital mutilation actually dropped significantly. Not because of anything, not because a lot of resources or charity work, but because, the society was educated, we had some sort of secular state, and there is a high level of awareness. So what I want to say is that what we observe is, we really need to have a say in, where, how anybody is going to support us as women. Right. We really need to have a say on that. This should not be, driven somewhere and just came to us. And that caused a lot of destruction that affected the women movement a lot, and it turned the women movement into spaces where people are trying to bend their agenda to access resources. And it's really very sad. We need to, have the imagination to deal with our own problem. We need to capture back our imagination, our ability, to deal with our own challenges. And this is a very, very important issue for us.
Does Rasha or Ria, do you have anything to say?
Yeah, I'd like to add to that. It's true, the challenge is we deal with our own patriarchal system, and then we go to the international community, and then we have another challenge. And it hurts, because you come to, you see countries, you can see that it's still patriarchal everywhere, but we can be also at least less patriarchal also. We're not just the way we are. We're doomed to be like this because we come from these countries who are just like that, you know? So we do have this multi-level of challenges. And and locally, it's legal, it's societal, it's institutional. It's women who are facing a challenge of being killed, you know, to start with, to being detained, to being, the simplest is to being disowned, is to being, is to disappear. We also, I mean, you mentioned the alliances and networking, and I think this is one of the things I learned, is that they really, really, the best way is to have alliances and networking within national, regional, and international. That's what makes me excited about being here too. And I think this is important, but it's also challenging when it comes to the differences, because we need to accept that they're different. We need to accept their places and where they are. It's important to have a woman, even in Yemen, for example, within the militia, if there are women there. If we can work together towards the goal, then they can be whatever they can be, you know?
I just have a question. What kind of resources are we injecting into the women's movements? Is it about just giving women money? What is it that you're giving women? You know, one thing I'm seeing these days is, it's like women's agenda or feminism has become a fancy word that everyone wants to do it. So I feel like even the space is being hijacked. It's about ticking boxes of, well, we are working for women. We are talking about girls' issues. But how are we talking about those issues? If we are speaking about girls being forced into marriage, how about we ask those girls how they feel rather than speaking up for them? I just want to add my voice also on the global networking, and I would really want to appreciate Oxfam for this. There is so much power in collaborating. I mean, coming from South Sudan, it's very difficult to work in that environment. But if I have a sister here, as she said, these days social media is really helping us. It's just a matter of sending her a text. I'm like, hey, this is happening. I cannot speak about it there, but please raise it for me there. And it becomes very fast. Before you know it, you know what is happening in South Sudan. You know what is happening in the UK, and it becomes a global issue. So networking is very important, and I thank Oxfam for organizing this.
I want to open it up to questions from the floor, but one last thing I know that quite a few people wanted to talk about on the panel was self-care. So, you know, we're operating in very stressful environments. As women, how do we make sure that we, you know, that we take care of ourselves? And I don't know I don't know who it was that wanted to speak on that.
All right. I passionately wanted to speak about self-care. I mean, I am 28 and I feel so tired already, and I feel so old. But I just wanted that if we leave this room, we should take care of us, because the personal is political. If you get tired, the body is tired. You're not going to continue speaking about these issues that we are passionate about. And so I request that we invest in women's human rights activists, we invest in their self, we invest in their care, because in most cases when we give resources, we give for activities and we don't even think about, oh, what is happening to this person's body, mind and spirit? Because if we don't have these people, then our work cannot go on. So I don't know, I wanted to request if you could play for us a little song, but I don't know if it's possible. But also, when was the last time you really danced where you were in the room? So please dance and find music in your work.
We're going to definitely fulfill your dream of playing some music at the end of the evening. Yeah. Thank you so much. I really meant it, that this is the most inspiring panel I've ever had the pleasure of chairing. So thank you so, so much. Thanks everyone so much for coming as well. We are going to give Ria her wish and kind of end the event with some music. So I hope everyone can stick around and have a drink. I think everyone is staying for a bit, so please come up and have a chat. And thank you to Oxfam for organising this great event. Thank you.
Women's rights are human rights. Let's unite across boundaries for equality and justice for all. I'm unstoppable.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear more from Oxfam, remember you can subscribe to Oxfam In Depth on all your major podcast providers.